Thank you very much, Leslie, for accepting the invitation to come on the Marketplace Discussions podcast. I think we coincided last year at the Unamuno House Museum. I was doing some research, you were doing some research, and you've been working on Unamuno. Is it safe to say that you specialize in Unamuno, or what is it that you do?
I think that's okay to say. First of all, thank you for the invitation to come on as well. I think I could be considered a specialist in Unamuno. My doctoral work and my first book were focused on Miguel de Unamuno. I teach Spanish literature courses in which I incorporate Unamuno's work, and I've taught full courses on just Unamuno himself. So I've spent a lot of time with Unamuno, and not really getting away from him, because he seems to somehow generate new conversations even today, and even when people in my field or the general public might think that Unamuno is sort of out of date, he appears again in sometimes unexpected places. So I work in a lot of areas of Spanish literature and culture and Iberian cultural history, I keep coming back to Unamuno.
Interesting. Yeah, and before we discuss who Unamuno was, for those who don't know Unamuno, but let's talk about you for a second. And how did you end up not necessarily specializing in Unamuno, but how did you end up doing literature? Is your PhD in literature?
Yes, in Hispanic literature.
Literature. How did you get there? I can tell you, I got into philosophy by mistake, because I liked Salamanca, for example. This is the real story. I wanted to stay here, so I was like, yeah, let me just sign up for an MA and do the PhD and stay here. And yeah, I was enjoying my time here, so I don't know about you.
Yeah.
Is it something similar?
In my story, travel to Spain was also a decisive moment in that development. I'm from the United States. And while I grew up in New Mexico and started learning Spanish from a pretty young age, my family is not, I'm the only Spanish speaker in my family. I don't have any personal connection to Hispanic cultures. But I was always a lover of literature and read a lot and knew that was something that was tugging at me when I began my college years, and went to Spain and studied abroad, and realized that this language that I'd been learning for a long time, I'd been kind of taking Spanish as my language for a long time, gave me access to a whole world of literature that I hadn't thought about. So after that experience, I went on to do graduate work in comparative literature. So I was working in multiple literatures, and then ultimately decided to do a PhD in Spanish to be able to do research and write and teach on Spanish culture in particular. And one of the interesting elements of my personal path that I think is significant is just the timing of my undergraduate career. My first week of college, and I went to a small school in the Midwest, in Michigan. My first week of college was the week of 9/11, of the attacks on the Twin Towers. Yeah. So that was obviously a very
first week.
The first week that I was in college. So that semester, and I credit some of the professors that I had that really encouraged me to reflect on what was going on in the world at that time. And so I was in the college career, and I was watching kind of the discourse coming out of the Bush administration in the United States, watching the involvement with Iraq, and processing this from a small Christian college in the United States, and watching things become more polarized politically within the United States. Then fast forward a few years, my third year of college, I went to study abroad in Spain, as I said, following this interest that I had had for a while. Was getting introduced to Spanish literature and learning so much about the history of Spain and its culture, and really learning as a college student a lot more about history in general, right? Yeah. My world was opening up. And that was the spring of 2004. So you might anticipate we went on a class trip to Madrid in late February or March of that year, and then a couple of weeks after I came back to, I was living in a town in Valencia. I came back and it was the March 11th, the 11M attacks and the
The
Atocha train
Madrid
station.
Metro, yeah.
Exactly.
Train Atocha, I think, if I'm not mistaken.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. That those attacks were first, erroneously attributed to ETA, to the Basque terrorist organization, and then linked to Al Qaeda. But that it had a very precise effect on the political discourse in Spain at the time. You might remember there were general elections happening, and Aznar, who had been very supportive of Bush's policies, was replaced by José Luis Rodríguez Zapatero. So, as a college student, I was watching all of this happen and noticed this geopolitical kind of matrix in which these two events kind of signaled an analogy or a connection between the United States and Spain. And I had been, as I said, learning about hi the history of Spain and becoming more aware of the ways in which historically Spain's dominance in the world had shifted, had been followed by the rise of US dominance, or you could say imperialism. Precisely, the kind of hinging point is the Spanish-American War of 1898. So that really affected me pretty profoundly. And I wasn't so much into Unamuno at that point, but now we can think of Unamuno as being very, pivotal in Spain in that whole discussion about the War of 1898 and Spain's response to that moment too.
Interesting, because I can so yeah the it's so the two events that maybe marked your or somehow had a direct influence on what you chose to study or focus on eventually are somewhat personal, but at the same time, like they relate to external kind of, as you said, the geopolitical matrix of how things were going at the time. And the reason why I'm bringing this up, just this is a tangent here, is because in my case, and I discussed this previously on a previous episode, I decided to do philosophy because of two events in my case, not necessarily similar, but it's like we had the Lebanese war, the war in Lebanon with Israel 06, even though I had lived other periods of war, but this one, like it's because of the, death becomes concrete. I'm older, I'm 17 years old, I think, in 2006, and so it had quite the effect on me. This is why I decided maybe philosophy has some answers there. And the other part is the financial crisis of 2008. So it's curious just to see you mention this as these two events happening and then how they might be related to each other and how they tie back with Unamuno one way or the other. So it's just curious. And then we can delve deeper into this, but so what happened afterwards? You so this kind of it does have an impact You're not really that much into Unamuno, but then you start comparing all these events and how things might arise or how things unfold, different events nationally and internationally. And you were like, okay, Unamuno somehow. How did that kind of materialize?
So Unamuno is one of the Spanish language writers that students who study Spanish in the US and I think many places eventually come in contact to. He's well, perhaps not very widely known broadly. He's continues to be a canonical author in Spanish literature classes for sure. And so I had been aware of Unamuno as an undergraduate. And then, this I had my study abroad experience and was very interested just in comparing, seeing what Spanish literature had to say about my experience in the US and comparing literatures and cultures more broadly. Fast forward, I did a master's in comparative literature. Didn't work so much with Unamuno, but developed a lot of thinking about questions of maturity in Europe, which would come to play later on in European modernism. And then I started my PhD and started reading other texts of Unamuno's. I think I had only read Samanuel Bueno Martir, the novella, at that point. And I read Niebla in a graduate seminar, my first semester as a PhD student. And that novel, this metafictional novel, very in a lot of ways that broke with a lot of the literary trends in Europe at the time, published in 1914. Caught my attention. It was taught to me in a class that presented Unamuno as kind of a forerunner to the Spanish avant-garde. So I was thinking about Unamuno in connection to a lot of writers later in the 1920s and into the 1930s. And at the same time, I was taking a seminar in literary translation, and I had to think about something, an author I wanted to translate. And I thought, huh, I wonder if there's something of Unamuno's that I could look into. And I noticed that he had written a lot of poetry. I hadn't read too much of his poetry prior to graduate study. But I started looking into that and realized that some of his poems hadn't been translated. So I went ahead and did some of that. So I was thinking about Unamuno in relation to European culture, something that I had studied in the previous years, in the modernist moment, and noticing that his poetry was an area of his work that was somewhat neglected. He was most known and most taught as an author of novels and philosophical essays, right? So that's how I sort of landed on the topic that would become the nucleus of my dissertation and my book and a lot of my thinking about Unamuno since then too.
Yeah, and I know this is maybe a bit late to even mention that, but then who was Miguel de Unamuno? I do
I would say
remember
that.
his dates, I think 1864, 1936, is it?
Yes, that's right. Yes, so Miguel de Unamuno was one of the most prominent intellectual figures of the early 20th century in Spain and a writer in many genres. So, as I just mentioned, he's most known today for his novels and philosophical essays, the most famous of which, and I think the one you probably taught, is The Tragic Sense of Life.
Not at all.
Ah,
I
not
taught, in
at all. That's
fact, San Manuel Bueno Martir and Niebla. I never taught. Yeah, but because it's always been like so some sort of either cultural studies course or existentialism in literature. So,
right. Got it.
yeah.
Okay. Well, it's I spent some time with The Tragic Sense of Life during my
Whoa.
PhD, and it's an interesting read. It's a difficult one to teach, I will give you. I've taught chapters of it. I've taught parts of it.
That's why I avoid it completely. Yeah.
But yes, he was born in 1864, so saw the end of the 19th century and lived through the beginning of the 20th century and died at the beginning of the Spanish Civil War in 1936.
December 31st.
Yes, the very last day of that year. And his activity in those last months is something that has been at the forefront of the cultural conversation about Unamuno in Spain recently, and something I've been following.
Yeah, also a tangent, sorry to interrupt, but
Yeah.
because these things do kind of, fascinate me. As I was doing some cataloging work of his correspondence, I came across a letter that I think, well, one of the files, it had, if I'm not mistaken, two letters from Kazantzakis, who actually came to Spain. Nikos Kazantzakis, he's a Greek, also existentialist, wrote Zorba the Greek, and he was a journalist at the time, and he came here. He wanted to interview Unamuno. So yeah, I just one of these anecdotes you come across, and as if it kind of, yeah, it's just interesting to me personally. I was like, oh my God, Nikos Kazantzakis was here, and he was at the Grand Hotel, and he actually managed to get an interview with Unamuno. And if I'm not mistaken, he wanted to interview Franco as well, but I don't know if this how this panned out. But yeah, anyway,
Right, because
sorry for
Franco
that.
was there as well.
At that time, yeah, it was right a few months, like it was maybe October, November, or he was on house arrest
Yeah.
when Kazantzakis was here. So yeah.
Right. But that anecdote gives a good indication of what a prominent figure Unamuno had become in Europe,
He
and
was like a
Europe
figure
abroad.
for them, for the revolutionaries in Greece. He was like, but everyone is waiting to hear what you have to
Oh,
say. Yes.
wow. I did
Yeah.
not know that. Oh, that's fantastic.
Yeah. But anyway, I'll stop here because it's yeah, it's exciting stuff. It gets me
Yeah.
excited for so yeah. Anyway.
Oh, that's wonderful. No, but that's true. And I think that you can really trace that back in Unamuno's life to the early 1920s. But I guess to give a little bit more
Yeah.
backstory on Unamuno, he was born in the Basque Country, so a native of Bilbao, and studied in Madrid, wrote his dissertation on the Basque language, actually, which is an interesting fact given some later positions he would take on the Basque language and other languages other than Castilian Spanish in Spain. But he came to Salamanca in 1890, started teaching, was a professor of Greek, so that explains some of the Greek connection probably too. And eventually becomes rector of the university, and is establishing himself writing so much in newspapers, periodicals, producing novels, producing poetry, all of these things. But then in beginning, well, I don't know where to put the beginning point, but during the First World War, he becomes quite critical of the Spanish government and the king, and has some run-ins where he's deposed from his rectorship. And then in 1924, just after a dictatorship had been established in Spain, the di dictatorship of Primo de Rivera, Unamuno was very outspoken against this regime and was actually forced into exile. So Primo de Rivera exiles him, sends him to the Canary Islands, where he lives for less than a year, and he eventually is pardoned, but he refuses to return home to Salamanca and instead opts to go to France and lives in exile during that whole dictatorship, which lasted from 1923 to 1930. So he's living for a bit in Paris and then in Hendaye in the French part of the Basque Country. And I think that moment is really critical for Unamuno's kind of fame in Europe because the press throughout Europe paid a lot of attention to this major intellectual figure within Spain who was criticizing, was living in exile out of political protest during that period. And Primo can be seen as in some ways a prelude to Franco's dictatorship later on, just to give some context. But so yeah, those are some highlights. I could say a lot more, but hopefully that gives the listeners a bit of an idea of Unamuno.
Yeah, and it's now that you mention it, it's interesting. I'm just thinking now he was in modern day terminology and lingo, he got canceled, and because he got canceled, kind of everyone, like everyone was sharing his tweets, and that's how he went viral somehow, and everyone was empathizing with him, and eventually he got to know, like, he was a major intellectual figure at the time. Like every so for I'll just to contextualize things nowadays. Again, I don't know, maybe the it's the circles within which one is moving, but I mentioned Unamuno a few months back, when I was with a group of people who are doing their PhD in philosophy. There was an Argentine and a couple of Argentines and a couple of Spaniards, and they were like, they just dismissed Unamuno as, this whatever, this guy there, he's not that important, But then the only reason why I myself know how important and how well known Unamuno was back in the day is because I got to check out his correspondence, and I came across all kinds of people sending him letters from across the globe. Like, absolutely, he wrote to Bergson. If I don't, I will not mention names because I'll only mention the ones I'm sure wrote to him or he wrote to them.
There's
Bergson
so
did
many.
write to him, Nikos Kazantzakis, and many U.S. Poets, intellectual figures, French, English, Italian, and it's like he knew, and in Spain, of course. I mean, he was well known, but then not only in Spain, but across the world. Like, he was receiving letters from Latin America, from I would even venture and say Australia or something. I don't know, like, it's weird places, right? So this is just on to highlight how important he was at the time, and his books were being translated to many languages, if I'm not mistaken, while he was alive, right? And yeah, so
Yeah, so
just
he was nominated for the Nobel Prize in
Nobel
Literature
Prize, yeah.
in the 1930s. I don't remember if it was 1936 precisely or
According
13.
to some, it was probably Hitler or something, or like the Nazis. Is
Right, there's
this is a theory I heard that apparently he didn't win it because of political intervention. I don't know if that's true or not.
That is, yeah, that is speculated. So
So
profile.
it's just, yeah, seriously, quite fascinating. Because so what happened? And we'll discuss all the other bits about maturity and stuff, because it's also interesting. But like, how can someone who, usually the story goes as the typical cliche, people like Nietzsche and the likes, right? They never sold books when they were alive. No one knew who they were. They had problems publishing, and then afterwards, all of a sudden, their books start selling, etc., etc., after like posthumously. So in the case of Unamuno, you have this guy who's well known, well read, or do it across the entire world. And all of a sudden, somehow, and this is maybe just an exaggeration, but almost, right, forgotten in the English-speaking world, at least. Because in Latin America speaking or Spanish-speaking world, maybe they still know who he is, particularly political, he has political influence, etc. What happened?
I think there are so many ways to answer this question. I think there are different things to say about the English language context and also about Spain and Latin America. But in terms of the English speaking world, I would say that is one of the things about Unamuno, that he was very much a man of his time. And he was, as we've discussed, he was such an important, prominent figure, commenting on so many contemporary issues during his day. He's very hard to separate completely from his time, I would say. His literary works and his philosophical ideas, that might be a different discussion, but so many of the things that really brought him to prominence in the press at the time were very linked to his historical period. So that's one thing. Another is that in the English-speaking world, I would say Spain, it occupies, especially in kind of the cultural panorama of the English-speaking world, Spain occupies kind of a minor position. If you think about the time that Unamuno was writing, the early 20th century, as I mentioned earlier on, Unamuno's writing in the period following the Spanish-American War, when a lot of Spanish intellectuals are trying to establish or figure out how to reestablish Spain's status on the global scene. Unamuno is very concerned with creating a Spanish literature that can compete kind of on the level of English or French. Kind of at this moment, French is maybe the dominant literary language, but as we can see now, English has become a dominant language in the remainder of the 20th century and the 21st century. So in some ways, Unamuno just had kind of the forces of time against him, in the sense that as a writer from Spain, he wasn't able to create that sort of literary cachet or that status, and make Spanish into a dominant language in world literature or even kind of thought, I would say, that dominance of the English language, and a continued dependence on kind of Northern European continental philosophy, that has worked in the has placed Spain at a marginal position. And we can go back to thinking about the place of Spain in relation to the rest of Europe as the country at the very southwest corner, very close to Africa, and with ties, historical ties, of course, to the Islamic world. There's a very much a European view of Spain as somewhat other, even within Europe, that's present in
Which is
working in the
usually the joke that
right.
even some Spaniards share every. At least I heard that from several Spaniards, like Europe ends at the Pyrenees or something, This is
Exactly. Even
the
the
view.
19th century, Spain, Africa begins at the Pyrenees, or Europe ends at the Pyrenees. This
Exactly.
and Unamuno was very much, in a moment when that was continued to be the case. Well, I would just say that the way that the English-speaking world looks at European culture continues to be influenced by that. So Unamuno, I would say, is one of, we're thinking of writers and thinkers from Spain. He's one of the few that some people may know. Another would be José Ortega y Gasset, 20th century philosopher. And in terms of philosophy, maybe Ortega y Gasset is more well known. And then, of course, the other literary figure would be Federico Garcia Lorca, the poet
Then,
who's killed a few months before Unamuno, also by the nationalist forces. But I think Unamuno, in some ways, never had the place in this English-speaking world that he could preserve. And in other ways, wasn't able to achieve it because of what happened after his death. So I would say in the early 20th century, a lot of Spanish writers were influenced by Unamuno. That's what my research has been about. And in the wake of the Spanish Civil War, although Unamuno had died, many of the writers who were influenced by him emigrated or were exiled to in the United States. They chose to leave, and they brought Unamuno with them. So that's part of the reason why Unamuno is taught so much in Spanish literature courses in the United States, for example, because his disciples really made him part of the curriculum that is read here, for example. And I think the same could be said in the UK, for example.
yeah,
But
it's
yeah, no, go ahead.
no, but it's at least in because I always is it so maybe it has to do with what happened and the fact that he never was able to kind of create a space for Spanish literature as such. And but I always compare Unamuno because to me Unamuno is just an existentialist, because I come from a philosophy background. So even though I read San Manuel Bueno Mártir and I read Niebla, I basically and I read like several of his essays and The Tragic Sense of Life. I did not read the entire book, but I did read many sections there. But so I always think of him as an existentialist who's fun to read. Particularly like Niebla and San Manuel Bueno Mártir, the topics and the themes that he's trying to explore in both, pretty like in a way it does talk about belief and death and stuff differently, San Manuel Bueno Mártir and the metafiction of Niebla. But and so I compare him to people like Sartre and Camus, who I think were somewhat directly or indirectly influenced by him. I'm almost sure, like this is speculation, of course, but it's I would I swear they did somehow read him, because also Cioran read Unamuno. He loved him, and the reason why I knew that is because as I was cataloging books, there was this he was translated into Romanian for some reason. I was like, why is Unamuno translated, and why is this author always translating Unamuno? And then I started looking into it, etc. But anyway, so is this also probably a problem of marketing, Spain versus France? Because France, I mean, I understand Derrida and all these people went to the US and they brought with them all this continental philosophy into the, US English departments and stuff like that. But is it also a maybe a question of marketing? Are the Spaniards, without affirming or I don't know, bad at marketing when it comes to, just I at least I feel like they don't know how to do that. It's like you have this guy, like why are you not doing anything about this? Whereas everyone knows Camus and Sartre, Sartre, he was a man of his time as well.
Of course.
But somehow, everyone, even if they didn't read him, you mentioned Sartre and everyone's like, oh yeah, Sartre. Yeah, this guy somewhere in France, but then they like, they recognize the name at least. Could it be that? I don't know. What
Yeah, the bad marketing, that's a great point. And I think that gets to the other part of what happened with Unamuno, that has to do with Spain, right? And it has to do with what happened after he died and also the content of his work. So, as you mentioned, a very central component in a lot of Unamuno's thought, which you see especially in San Manuel Bueno Mártir, is the question of religion. And as a Spanish philosopher, Unamuno is very concerned with reconciling religious faith with modern rationality. Or maybe it's probably not fair to say he's interested in reconciling them, but he's dealing constantly with the tension that he perceives between these things. And he writes, I mean, his so much of his writing, not all of it, but so much of his writing is imbued with this question of immortality and relationship to the relationship between faith and doubt, very much in a Christian tradition, right? So those ideas are compelling, and I think I agree with you. He presents them in a very a way that's fun to read. His writing gets students engaged always still. I think that's part of his continuing relevance. But of course, this religious question becomes very complicated in Spain, if it wasn't already, when Francisco Franco comes to power. And what happens with Unamuno is very curious because he dies under house arrest, imposed, an unofficial house arrest imposed by the nationalists. And his stance in relation to the Spanish Civil War was ambiguous. He expressed support for the nationalists initially, and then later criticized fascism, was actually a very strong critic of fascism already from the 1920s. But his relationship to Franco in particular, or to the nationalist uprising, was very hard to discern during that period. So it was not clear whether Unamuno died as a martyr for the Republic or somehow was supporting Franco in some way. And a lot of the recent cultural production about Unamuno's life has to do precisely with this question. What happens is that right after Unamuno dies, the nationalists, he's in Salamanca, which is Franco's headquarters, right? So the nationalists take control of the narrative, and he's given a Falangist burial, a burial by the rebel forces, Franco's side. And that narrative is controlled from that point. So Unamuno's legacy see in the following years in Spain, the people who write about Spanish literature and Spanish culture are able to enshrine Unamuno in the Spanish canon because of his interest in faith, actually. This question about the relationship between faith and doubt and immortality is understood in a very much in terms of a Catholic tradition. A Spanish tradition that is bound up with Catholicism. And this happens, this isn't Franco really doing this, but it's the literary critics who are writing under the Franco regime. And Unamuno becomes somewhat associated with this religious identity, this religious Spanish identity. And curiously, at the same period, the 1950s, the Catholic Church is saying that Unamuno's writings are not orthodox, and they're prohibiting, they're banning them. He's on the index of banned books. But this presence, this firm presence of Unamuno within the Spanish traditional literary canon becomes a real problem by the end of the dictatorship, because when you get to the end of the Franco regime, a lot of people in Spain want to move away from, there's a clear break with traditional Catholic culture, at least in the cultural realm, right? So I think that kind of relationship to religion, or that concern with questions of faith, particularly, filtered through Franco's dictatorship and the ways Unamuno was maybe manipulated. Plays a part to make Unamuno not a really attractive figure for, as you were saying earlier, philosophy students in Spain or even in Latin America.
Interesting.
I think that cultural and political history has a lot to do with his status in Spain, and also then the reason why he wasn't maybe marketed so successfully in the
Makes
mid-century.
sense. Interesting. That's see the yeah, I whereas people like Sartre and Camus, even though they were struggling and trying to reconcile, not in the same way, but they do. Yeah, no, in the case of Sartre, it's already atheism. Camus, a bit ambiguous, but either way, it's like there isn't. So there isn't that entire kind of hassle with Franco. So it does make sense, because Unamuno was really trying to believe somehow, but then he was aware that it's kind of difficult to know whether or not there is something out there, and reason by itself cannot console the human beings, the desires and the emotions, and in general, what makes us humans of flesh and bone, as he would say, and this is where his philosophy comes in. And the reason why he was trying to do all that is because at some point, his son Raimundo, if I'm not mistaken, was ill. He was just 1 year old or something, and then he died. And is this where he had this crisis breakdown kind of thing? Was it then or before or after?
This is the moment that a lot of people attribute to which people attribute Unamuno's existential crisis, the illness of his son Raimundo, and later death. And certainly he has many writings from this period. This is the very turn of the century, last years of the 19th century, and early years of the 20th. I think it's 1897 where some of the writings are written when he's dealing with this, the fact that this innocent child has hydrocephaly and likely will not live very long, in fact, in it. I think that it's been very useful to point to that moment in Unamuno's life and say this is where he starts to doubt. And there are certainly writings that support that. He was certainly writing about these themes earlier in his life as well. And even in relation to the question of, the Spain's status in the world, he was thinking about this also before 1898, the Spanish-American War. So these are preoccupations that had been present in Unamuno for a long time. What does happen in that moment? There seems to be a renewed turn to the question of religious tradition and whether a faith tradition can provide solace for this sort of problem. But I think it's really difficult to pinpoint this one moment in Unamuno's life, because he would go on to evolve in his thought many times. There's a period where he's very interested in Protestantism. These years after that child's illness, this is when he starts reading Kierkegaard, for example, and becomes very imbued with existentialism. But he also moves back to the Catholic tradition, and you see a lot of influence of Catholicism, especially in The Tragic Sense of Life later on. So he takes a lot of different positions. And the criticism is really all over the place in terms of whether he actually was a believer or not. Some people see that crisis moment as the beginning of Unamuno's atheism, and others see that as the moment in which he starts to believe. Obviously, he's wrestling with these questions for the rest of his life. So there's probably no clear answer at any given moment.
A man of dichotomies, because I so as part of the research I was doing, also I as a cultural kind of project, right? I wrote about philosophical heritage, and the title was some, or I was kind of interested in this, the man of dichotomies in this case, you know, the faith and reason, and then many other things. And one of, or the main kind of topic that I wanted to, or hypothetically, you know, explore was this dichotomy between the local national kind of Unamuno versus the international Unamuno who's traveling, because he traveled around Spain a lot and then he traveled around Europe a lot. And a lot has been written about his travels within Spain and not that much about his travels in Europe. So now that you mentioned also, you know, his influence in Europe, and you did touch on this a little bit, so I don't know if this is something that also in general might interest you as an idea, because yeah, these dyke he's yeah, this is why I think he appeals to both camps in general, because you can read him any way you want, and whether or not he was this or that, it doesn't really matter, because at the end of the day, we have his writings. He's not here anymore, and so this is where interpretation might come in. But so it's curious, because nowadays there are, I would say, at least in Salamanca, without mentioning names and stuff, there are like three different groups reading and discussing Unamuno, right? And they are from the entire political spectrum. So it's just curious how someone like Unamuno would appeal to so many people from different political kind of from different political camps. But
But there's a
yeah.
couple of aspects to that. One is that his work puts the reader in the position of needing to respond, right? So you can interpret him in many different ways because his literary works are provocation, right? And that can create that gives the interpreter a lot of freedom. That's one thing. And then the other thing I would say is just the archive on Unamuno, as you know, is vast. His works are vast, and you can find him writing and saying everything
I think
to support and contradict every position. He wrote so
he
much.
was a troll. I think he was a troll. I honestly, genuinely think he was a troll. That's why I think he was a showman in a way. Like he loved just he was a disruptive figure. He was this is the troll in a good sense, not in a bad sense. A troll in the sense that he was disruptive, and it shows in the way he approached education and the way he wrote, as you said, it's provocation. And but provocation in the in my case, maybe this is the Kierkegaard influence, perhaps, I don't know. And maybe there's, come to think about it, an article there to be written. I don't do academia anymore. I quit. Not my cup of tea, but maybe this is the irony, Socratic irony, right? And the Socratic kind of disruption in a way, because it's like you're if I'm having lunch with you and you're supporting Franco, again I'm this is a caricature of things, right? Simplification, but I'm gonna be a Republican. I'm sitting with a Republican, I'm gonna support Franco. It's like I feel that there might be some sort of, you know, a showman, disruptive troll in him, besides the actual kind of Unamuno who's deeply struggling to reconcile these dichotomies, like with this part the bipartisanship in Spain, and then he's trying to find like some sort of middle ground. This is why he says neither those nor those.
Neither the one or the other,
Yeah.
unos y los otros. Yes, I mean he's a contrarian, and that's
Yeah.
part of, you can imagine him in the classroom taking that sort of Socratic stance, or just that simple contrarian stance. And I think that's, you see that throughout his life. And that's what's so, what creates a problem for his legacy during the era of the Civil War, because he was very much a supporter of the Second Republic in Spain when it was created, but very quickly started to criticize it in a period when Spain was very polarized between those who supported the Republic and those who were turning against it, between broadly right and left, although it was much more complicated than that as well. Unamuno was the first to troll or to critique. And he did that right up until, the last few months of his life, and continued in his latest writings while he was under house arrest to say these things about, on both sides, people are, going to extreme positions. They're missing the, they're failing to respond to the moment. There's this, he's critical of extremist positions to the end of his life. And that's part of his appeal today, and the reason that he can be invoked so easily, and also part of the thing that makes him dangerous today as well, right? Because
Tell me more, because this
he
is,
wants to position himself.
tell me more about this. I'm curious, like, why it's so this is part of his appeal, but also part of why he might be dangerous.
Well, I think I mean there's many ways to look at this, but his appeal certainly for people on the far right, Santiago Abascal has quoted him, and people on the far left, Catalan independence politicians have also quoted
Interesting.
Unamuno. Because you can take it's very easy to use him in a contrarian debate to denounce the other party, right? Part of his appeal today culturally is also the fact that he was so involved in this these early moments of the Spanish Civil War, and the story about his relationship to the uprising and then his denunciation of the fascists, famously on October 12th, the day of what used to be called the Hispanic race. Those are kind of legendary moments that are being returned to now as Spain continues to deal with the question of historical memory and how do we understand the Spanish Civil War? How do we understand the Franco period? And there have been several films about this part of his life. Alejandro Amenábar's While at War, which came out in 2019. And then more recently, I don't know if you've seen this documentary by Manuel Menchon, Words for the End of the World.
I'm aware of it, but I have not seen it yet.
Menchon takes a very, well, it's a documentary, so he takes an investigative approach to what happened during the last months of Unamuno's life. Amenábar's movie is very much kind of Hollywood
It's
style,
a nice
telling
movie,
the
by the way.
story. It's very well done. But Menchon goes more into questioning the official narrative and suggests that that official narrative, sort of as I was saying before, was very much influenced by the manipulation of the nationalist side after Unamuno's death. So, as Spain is still dealing with questions of, street names that have been named for Franco or other people in his regime, and kind of readjusting this history, we just a few weeks ago, Jose Antonio Primo de Rivera was the other dictator's son. And one of the creators of this fa Spanish Fascist Party has been removed from the monument that Franco created to where Franco was buried, and where Primo de Rivera was buried as well. So Spain is trying to wrestle with these kind of public memory, public monuments of memory, and national understanding of the Civil War. And Unamuno is bound up in that. So I think that's part of why he's a hot topic, or I don't know if a hot topic is the is going too far, but he's come up a lot in recent films. Whether that is something that will transcend beyond Spain is also an interesting question,
That's
because in the US, this history isn't as well known, right? I can talk about this in my Spanish culture classes, but the nuances of this part of Spanish history are not as well known. So again, Unamuno has this problem with transcending to a wider public.
And well, I don't this is to me this is very interesting to be honest, because it does explain at least why he's not that well known. Because first off, two things. I don't know if you still have time to, because I if you have some time, I would also love to discuss the youth and maturity topic. But before we do that, also very briefly, do you think, and the also the American Spanish War, because it seems to be important there, and I don't know absolutely anything about how Unamuno was involved in any of that, so I'm interested to know about this. But is it, do you think that this is maybe why he hasn't yet transcended the Spanish kind of scene, because it's all the political aspect of his writings and stances, and no or very few people, very few between brackets, have maybe discussed his philosophy, literature, and poetry in this case? Is it because the focus is always on Unamuno? Not the politician, but there was an exhibition last year called Unamuno and Politics, right? So it's
Right.
this involvement of Unamuno in politics. I mean, and he was the rector of the University of Salamanca, and he had to deal with all these local authorities and stuff like that.
Sure.
So is it because of that? And afterwards, we can just jump right into, like, you can take the conversation from there into the maturity, youth, and
Sure.
yeah.
Sure. I don't know if it's because of that. I think it plays a role, and it certainly has to do with the way Unamuno is seen, as I said, within Spain today. I do think that his literary works have received a certain amount of reception worldwide, certainly very well known in Latin America, not only in Spanish-speaking countries, in Brazil. There's been a lot of reception of Unamuno's work. And in the US, you can say it's minor, but there are some interesting areas where Unamuno has really penetrated into American literature. For example, a lot of American poets did actually read Unamuno, and he continues to pop up. Recent poets. I was actually in Madrid in 2019 for a Unamuno Authors Festival, which was a group of poets who had come, English language poets who had come to participate in this festival named for Unamuno. It was created by the American poet Spencer Rees, who's also happens to be a priest. But at that festival, there's several of the poets who came were quite well known in the US, high profile writers. And there's something of a tradition of turning to Unamuno. Mark Strand cited Unamuno in one of his later works, The Monument. Christian Wiman, who is a contemporary poet, has cited Unamuno in his essays, and you can see an influence there. So again, that's not the mainstream, I would say. The poetry world in the US is not, we can't call it a mainstream anymore. But there are some pockets of influence. But I do think part of the reason why some of Unamuno's works are not as well known is that they haven't, especially kind of the prose works, the novels, and the essays, is that they haven't continued to be translated, and in some cases have never been translated. So that's also a component. There are some great translations of those works, but I think the trends in academia and the literary market also kind of affect who gets translated and who's returned to and whatnot. So that's my guess. And I've tried to do some of my part translating a bit of Unamuno and writing about him. And hopefully I'll teach him in translation the coming year. But there's work to be done in that area, I guess I would say.
Yeah, and but it does make sense, in fact. And yeah, the I think I've come across the book they published as a proceedings, I think, to the Conference of the Poets. And I think I have, because I do recall cataloging something similar last year. So if I'm not mistaken, it would be that. But see, this is the thing, as layman in my case, I see that and I'm like, yeah, these are just not to offend anyone, these are just a group of poets. I mean, they have their world and that's it. But yeah, so tell us, yeah, if you wanna discuss that bit as well, I'm all ears. So
Well, what I would just say, kind of following on that comment, is it was really important for me that that was a poetry festival, actually, because a lot of my work has been focused on Unamuno's poetry and also his relationship to poetry as a genre. And I mentioned before that his most well-known works are the philosophical essays and the novels. But Unamuno often referred to himself as primarily a poet and kind of thought of poetry as the essence of what he was doing. He writes about this a lot. He didn't publish poetry, he didn't start writing poetry until he was 40. But he really came to poetry as the perfect genre or mode for the expression, I think, of a lot of his thought, his philosophical thought. Because poetry, and he would invoke the Greek word poesis a lot, which
Oh,
means
interesting.
creation, right? Unamuno, if we focus on this tension between faith or the non-rational and the rational within Unamuno's thought and work, for Unamuno, poetry was a form of writing that embodied that tension between rational production and irrational. The effects of sound and rhythm that in a poem can overwhelm or produce emotion in a unique way that can't necessarily be explained is something that that he came to late, but that he found really compelling. And there's a lot of discussion about whether Unamuno was actually a good poet or not, whether he actually produced really, successful poems. Some critics have said he, didn't really have a good ear. But I got converted over to his poetry because he has a whole, I would say, philosophy of poetry as a form of creation, as a form of, as a way to navigate that tension between the rational and the irrational. As a modernist writer, he does something that other writers of the early 20th century in Europe are doing, which is to find kind of art or poetry, particularly, as a stand-in for religion. And I don't think Unamuno goes that far, but I do think he finds in poetry a kind of a perfect expression of what he's looking for in navigating the tension between faith and skepticism, let's say.
So
don't know if I'm
not because he was also well he did draw. I wouldn't know say he was an artist. He does have several paintings as well. But so it's not only art, because usually this is what philosophers would invoke or would suggest as an alternative to religion in that sense, art. But in his case, not only art, but poetry in particular, if we can call that art as well.
Poetry in particular. Yeah, for him, poetry
Interesting. This is the first
is
time
sort of the
I.
overarching kind of the or art, right? And he referred to all of his, and there's one document from the early 20th century where he refers to all of his writing, all of his novels, his drama, all of that sort of creative writing work as poetry in some sense. And I think that explains a lot about as to why he was an important literary writer, and why you're teaching, his narrative, his fiction as philosophy, because I think that was the mode in which he was best able to express his thought about modern existence and the relationship between kind of the legacy of enlightenment rationality and all that is beyond that.
Did he talk about, or did he explore also maybe myth? Because you're mentioning poetry, so I'm thinking, maybe Hesiod and these people.
Yes, and I mean, as I said before, he was a professor of Greek language
Exact.
and
That's why I'm,
literature.
yeah.
So, his references,
And Homer
there are
and people.
mythological references in his work, in his poetry, and that is of interest to him. But certainly, it is the case that in Unamuno, his kind of span of reference is always centered in the Christian
Okay,
tradition and
okay.
that legacy. So very much kind of in the tradition of his time, reading the classics kind of through that lens. I think that's very much the case for Unamuno, which also can explain part of this question of his enduring appeal, right? Because he's very much, whether or not he was a believer or not, or what have you, what he actually thought about Christianity, that was his frame of reference, and
Exactly.
he doesn't veer too far from that.
Culturally, like even if it's not religiously, culturally within the Christian tradition, and
Exactly.
it does make sense. And we can, because we can end with the, if you want to say anything on, because I'm curious about the American Spanish War now, like I'm and Unamuno. So I don't know if you want to say anything, and this we can end on this note as well.
About
So
Unamuno studies in
yeah, it's yeah, anything you'd like to share about this, because it seems to have been an important kind of event.
So there certainly has been an important legacy of Unamuno's work in the United States. As I mentioned earlier, a lot of the writers from the early 20th century who go into exile after the Civil War had studied under Unamuno or were influenced by Unamuno. The Hispanist Federico de Onís, who founded kind of the Spanish department at Columbia University, had studied with Unamuno in Salamanca. Other writers like Pedro Salinas, who is a very prominent poet in 1920 Spain, goes into exile in the United States and puts Unamuno's work in the hands of the first person to translate his poetry into English, Harriet Turnbull. And many of these writers remember Unamuno kind of as that Unamuno in exile from the 1920s, and see him kind of marking a path forward for them as well. Some of them invoke Unamuno's writings from exile during that time. And these people do kind of create the syllabus for Spanish literature in the United States. So he's a fixture on a lot of in a lot of Spanish literature courses.
Yeah, no, but the actual the American Spanish War, because you mentioned
Oh.
this, yeah, is it was did Unamuno get involved? Like, did he write? It's when was the 1890?
1898. 1898.
Yeah.
So this war, it starts as a Cuban war for independence, and with the sinking of the USS Maine in the in let's see, February, I think, of 1898, the United States becomes involved in the war. It's a very short war. Spain kind of assumes that they're going to be able to defeat the United States, but that is not at all the case. The United States, by the end of the year, has won, and the transfer of Spain's last colonies in the Americas and in the Pacific occurs. So Puerto Rico, the Philippines, and Cuba are lost. Cuba eventually gains its independence. And so that moment, well, the majority of the population in Spain maybe wasn't paying too much attention to that. For the intellectual community in Spain, people like Unamuno, who had already been quite concerned about Spain's place in the world, the fact that those last overseas colonies, with a few other exceptions, right, have now gone over to the United States. It kind of it creates something of a crisis of identity. The common phrase used at the time was "el problema de España," the problem of Spain. And this is something that motivates a lot of writing about regeneration, the regeneration of Spain. So, and Unamuno is very much a part of that whole tradition. He's one of the major thinkers about how can we regenerate Spain already from before this conflict, which kind of clinches things on a geopolitical level.
Yeah, that's in fact quite interesting, because you do discuss like this. There's an entire zeitgeist in a way of literature about youth in Europe, and maybe regeneration now comes in, and it adds the mix. So this is, they feel on the one hand they're losing everything, but then on the other hand they're trying to rediscover themselves in a way.
Right. Yeah, precisely. So what I go into in my book is thinking about Unamuno's writing and his influence on other Spanish writers during this period in connection to what was happening in Europe. This is a period in which higher education is becoming more established. There are more child labor laws. Many youth organizations are being created, and youth is kind of seen as a new category in the stages of life. If we at one point we had kind of childhood and then merged to adulthood pretty seamlessly, the early 20th century youth and adolescents are new categories. And Unamuno is, of course, reading writers from all over Europe. There are literary writers, but also people thinking about pedagogy and about psychology who are turning to this category of youthfulness and adolescence. Unamuno's imbibing this, and at the time when Spain is looking for some sort of regeneration, it's very useful to think of a young Spain as something that could insert, as a nation that could insert itself in Europe in a new and productive way. So Unamuno latches on to this discourse of youth, and as I look at in the book, his early poetry involves a lot of commentary on youth and age. and his early essays as well, kind of the first essays that build up to things like The Tragic Sense of Life, are actually essays that are written for young people and are actually reprinted and read by the next couple of generations of writers during this early 20th century period, in which Unamuno really speaks about youth in a wide range of contexts, as a religious category, but also as a social category, as an artistic category, and really it inspires a lot of thinking in later writers about art as eternal youthfulness.
I was going to ask about that. Is this kind of maybe you already mentioned it as eternal youthfulness, kind of does this tie with his idea of tragic sense of life, like the longing of immortality in a sense? Well, I always want to be young in spirit, at least to enjoy. I don't know how this translates, right? I philosophically
Exactly.
I can only think about it in a way, but is
Yeah. I would say so. And this is where I, as a literary critic or a cultural historian, kind of add on to something that has been said a lot about Unamuno's thought, the importance of not only I've talked a lot about faith and doubt, but also the importance of immortality. And Unamuno's main question is, how can I be finite when I have this desire to, to live on, and this longing for immortality, which he traces, as we've said, to the Christian tradition. And art is a way to transcend and to attain some sort of immortality. The piece that I add there is to note that he also frames this as eternal youthfulness. And so this idea of transcendence through art is also very much connected to a category that was very important socially and culturally in Europe in the early 20th century. And that later writers, so some of the people that came up after in the subsequent generations so that Unamuno had contact with, even people like Federico Garcia Lorca, in the 20s, called themselves, actually referred themselves at to referred to themselves as young writers. The young literature was kind of their name that they gave themselves, their title, and that association with youthfulness. Those writers have not often been linked to Unamuno, who's seen as by that point kind of an older, stodgy, contrarian, as we were saying. But that I try to trace that link with Unamuno, and I would just say that as we were talking about before, a lot of the energy in Unamuno's writing really connects with young people. I found teaching, college students, in his prose, maybe to a less extent actually in his poetry, but some students, there's the rare student who gets into poetry. He really appeals to young writers and thinkers. So there's something there in that category of youthfulness and thinking about Unamuno as an eternally youthful thinker and writer. I hope at least.
And he like this is extremely interesting to me, because I've always been thinking about how he would redeem himself in that way, like the longing for immortality. How do you transcend that? And it looks like it's basically that. So it's art creation, poesis in a way, but also not a poesis where you're stagnant, but poesis whereby it's constantly kind of, creating. And for Unamuno, he embodied this in his own life, because even though, how old was he when he passed away?
72.
72. So up until his death, the guy was not only spiritually and not only intellectually, but he was physically kind of quite fit. The guy was hiking, the guy was out and about, and he was, so he embodied this spirit not only through his poetry and art and literature, but also actually physically out there. So the guy, in a way, he wanted to connect with this eternal kind of youth, both physically and intellectually. I don't know if I'm saying weird stuff here, but this is my weird interpretation of it. But yes, forgive me.
I think probably some critics would disagree, but I think that is Unamuno's aspiration throughout his life. And there's a wonderful poem from his first collection of poetry, that one that I kind of first landed on, that started my research. There's another one that is pretty well known, and it's called For After My Death. And that's a poem that's been studied a lot in relation to Unamuno's longing for immortality. But there's another poem in that collection called For When I Am Old, or When I Am Old. And that poem is a dialogue in which Unamuno imagines himself as an old person having an argument with a younger generation of writers who tell him that they understand his poetry better than he does because they're young. And at the end of that poem, he goes back and forth and he says, I'll be yelling at you, I'll be fighting against you, but you'll be right. And if anything, that I'm totally paraphrasing here because I don't have it in front of me, but if my writings mean anything in the future, it will be the young readers who will decide. So he kind of places that hope for the future and that hope for a sort of immortality through his writing in the interpretation of future younger readers.
Yeah, that's extremely interesting, and a good way kind of to end this honestly fascinating conversation. I've enjoyed this a lot, so thank you very much for again accepting the invitation. And I don't know, this is the usual question, right? I don't know if you're on social media or if anyone wants to reach to you, how can they find you?
Well, thank you so much for the invitation. This has been a real pleasure. And I am on Instagram only at Leslie J. Hanselma.
Yeah, well, that's good enough. But thank you very much, Leslie. And thank you, everyone, for listening. And I did not mention this before, but this is Unamuno was... I hope Unamuno enjoyed the conversation as well. He was looking at us, and this is just interesting. So thank you very much, and have a good day, everyone.